We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. Now here's your program.
And good morning. Welcome to hour number two of Focus. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. The producers for the program, Harriet Williams and Martha Deal, Jason Croft is at the controls. In this hour of the show, we will be looking for your questions on prescription drugs. And our guest for the program this morning is James Rybacki. He is the author of a series of books, The Essential Guide to Prescription Drugs. He's now getting ready to launch or is in the process of launching a new website to provide a lot of the same material via the Internet. He taught for a number of years at the University of Maryland. He's been with us before here on the program, not in a while, but we're really pleased to have him back to answer questions. There are a number of things that we can talk about if people have questions about medicines that they're taking, potential side effects, what's the right way to take them, interactions between drugs. Those are the kinds of things we've been talking about here. And certainly, if people have questions about the business of how it is that drugs get approved, I think probably we could talk about that. Just about anything that has to do with prescription drugs or over-the-counter medications, I'm sure Dr. Rybacki will do his best to answer your question. Whatever we have health people on programs, and we have a lot of physicians on the show, I like to start out by saying to people that we can't do diagnosis over the telephone, but we do these shows to try to help you out and give you a place that you can come and ask questions. And as I said, I'm sure that Dr. Rybacki would do his best to answer whatever kinds of questions people might have. Here in Champaign-Urbana, if you are listening and you want to call, the number is 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line, so if it's long-distance call, use that one. Calls on us. That's 800-222-9455. We do also have email, and that is will-talk at illinois.edu. So if you'd rather send along your question that way, you certainly should feel welcome to do that. And Dr. Rybacki, hello.
Hi, David. How are you?
Well, I'm pretty good. How are you?
Oh, the adventure continues, as always.
Well, I'm really pleased you could spend some time with us. We're grateful that in the past that you could do some shows. We always got a lot of calls. And, you know, it's one of those things where we know that people are always going to have questions, and they may not have time to talk about it with their doctors, or might not even think to ask the pharmacist wherever they get their prescriptions filled. And I'm sure that people do have lots and lots of questions about the medicines that they take.
Oh, how can you not? The information, the guidelines, the research, the publications seem to change almost daily. And if I have a problem keeping up, people like my mom, people without a medical background, certainly would.
Sure.
I mean, it's remarkable when you look at one conference coming up with one particular kind of data, a different one going, well, I'm not sure we should really do that. And then the guidelines, of course, have a little bit of a guideline backlog. And so people end up going, who do I talk to? I would advocate, though, that if there's a question and your doctor looks busy or your pharmacist looks busy, if you have to tackle them, it's okay to tackle them. This is Dr. Rybacki promoting tackling healthcare provisions, because you have to know. And otherwise, taking that pill the wrong way or not taking enough of it can be a prescription for disaster, and that's not what we want to have happen. That's not what your doctor wants to have happen, or your pharmacist or your nurse practitioner, even though they're all busy. You're the patient, and the current concept in U.S. healthcare is patient-centered care. It's okay to ask questions.
Well, and I'm sure I want to talk for a minute here about Essential Guide to Prescription Drugs.com, because as I mentioned that, you know, for a number of years you had done these books, and they're gigantic books. They're packed with a lot of good information. But I'm sure the problem with a book is that as soon as it's printed, it's out of date, at least in the sense that you can't continually update. And I would expect that your interest in trying to go to a web-based thing gives you that opportunity to always have new stuff there.
You just hit one out of the park at Wrigley Field. That's exactly it, because frankly, any book, it's probably at least, and that's a good case scenario, 6 months, quote-unquote, out of date. And so what I'm going to do via the site is to actually release some sections of the book. Number of them will be at no charge. I feel a big duty to this. And obviously some of them will be some newsletters and some updates that we will charge for, but largely as PDFs. So it's really easy to download. It's completely flexible when the information changes. and it'll become something that is not dated. It'll have a version date on it instead of a, hey, this is it for the year. Not going to happen. We'll compile those on an annual basis.
And I think that the at least the last version I've seen of the book, was that the one for 2006?
That's exactly right, 1,360 pages.
And I'm sure that a lot of that, because I'm sure that people are still taking the medicines that are in that book, so so that the information that's there, I'm sure, is still fine. And if people are looking for some information about medicines that they may be taking, that would be one place that they could continue to go.
It would be a place to start. And what I would advocate very clearly is to look at the date of a particular book and then open that dialogue up with your doctor and your pharmacist. Well, geez, you know, Dr. Smith, I'm taking this cholesterol medicine, and this Rybacki book seems to say something about targets. What do we do with that? Those, of course, come from the guidelines. And since 2006, the guidelines have changed. Mm-hmm. So the targets are a little bit more aggressive. And it says, you know, let's get to target a little bit faster, and there's more potent drugs to do it with.
Yeah. All right. Well, again, our guest this morning, Dr. Thomas Rybacki, or I'm sorry, Jim Rybacki. He's a pharmacist by his academic training, I'm on the faculty at University of Maryland for a number of years, did this series of books, and the most recent is The Essential Guide to Prescription Drugs 2006. So that certainly is something that you could look at, but he's working on rolling out this website, which over time, I think he's planning on growing and adding material to, that it's aims at providing a lot of the same kinds of information, and that is Essential Guide to Prescription Drugs. That's all, like, all is one word, no spaces, essentialguidetoprescriptiondrugs.com. So take a look at that. We do have a caller here ready to go, so I will go ahead and get to them. And
right.
This is someone who's listening in Bloomington, Illinois, and calling on our toll-free line. This is line 4. Hello.
I've been taking Zoloft for stress and depression, and I'm just curious about recent studies showing that it's really not any more effective than other, for example, St. John's wort. I'm asking specifically because of side effects that have been kind of uncomfortable and unfortunate. So
looking at that, the question... Zoloft is sertraline, been around for a long time, so that's also in the 2006 Essential Guide to Prescription Drugs. The first question I would say is about the kind of side effects that you're having, and you've been taking this at a set dose, it's not been changed, and then, of course, the key outcome is, how has it helped that feeling that you're treating? Have they gotten better as a result of it?
It's difficult to say. I've just been on it for a couple of weeks.
Okay. Key thing there for all of our listeners, with medicines in this family in general, some of the potential side effects are nuisance side effects. Yep. Some people feel a little jittery from it. Some people don't. Some people feel a little sleepy. But those may go away in time. A key thing, though, is that our brains are pretty well protected. Well, my wife would say my brain isn't as well protected, but most people's brains have a very good barrier around them. And so what that means is it takes a while to get a therapeutic level. You may be a month out before a peak effect, before a peak benefit.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting point. Did you talk to your doctor about that?
I have, yes, and he was kind of vacillating on what might not happen.
You know, the other thing is if I take 100 people, I give them the same dose of a proven drug, sertraline. Some of them will get a benefit earlier. Some of them may take 6 weeks. Some of them be right at 4. And if there are side effects that are troublesome, then you need to call your doctor about that and follow up on that. But the other question you asked is actually a very astute one. What about St. John's wort? Well, St. John's wort, from a reliable, standardized, well-crafted purveyor of that particular product, can have tremendous benefits. That's an interesting point. And that, usual thing for those things, Cochrane database and some of the other complementary alternative medicine sites, there's good data for that. Now, the question about side effects and how that compares to a sertraline, you need to talk to your doctor about that. Involve your doctor so that you get the right dose, adjust it over time, and then make sure you set that target. But it's an interesting idea.
Okay.
The other thing I would add, though, please don't combine them.
Oh.
Because you're taking a drug that hits the same target, and you can have a problem with a neurotransmitter, a brain transmitter called serotonin. Getting too much of it is not a good idea. So don't do that without talking to your doctor. Tapering one in concert with your doctor, starting the other one, and then moving forward.
Great.
Great question.
All right. Well, thank you very much. And other questions are welcome. 333-9455. Toll-free 800-222-9455. You also may email will-talk@illinois.edu. And we're talking this morning with Dr. James Rybacki. He is a pharmacist. He's president of the Medicine Information Institute. He's author of the series of books, The Essential Guide to Prescription Drugs, and also now has taken that to the web. So if you're interested, look at theessentialguidetoprescriptiondrugs.com. And if you have questions about medicines that you are taking, he will do his best to help you out and maybe talk with you about some of your concerns. So again, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455, and email will-talk@illinois.edu. I wonder if I might just ask you a question. This is not real profound, but I moved to ask it because I've read a number of things lately on this subject, and it has to do with how people should dispose of old medicine. And maybe also it might involve the question, well, how old is too old? And if it's 6 months past its date, is that okay? If it's a year past, you say, well, maybe that's not okay. What about that?
Here's the challenge with that. It depends on what medicine we're talking about. So in general, medicines themselves, hospitals and hospital pharmacies are being really challenged by this. There's some RCRA legislation, and I was actually out in a California hospital in 2005, and so the disposals there are very, very strict. One of the questions you might do is to talk to your pharmacist about that and ask if they can help in disposing of it, because what we've heard is that fish in New York City, because of what's being dumped into the toilets and then recycled and then maybe having some water and ground table issues have some components of prescription drugs in them. So the FDA is taking a really good look at this, and that's something that we need to be careful of. The second question you're asking is one of relative potency, and you are a dog for asking me that question. That's a little bit of a complicated one, but in general, that outdate is sort of targeted at about 90% potency or greater. And so when you look at it, if I were to say, well, okay, so your transplant medicine is this far out of date. Would you take it? Absolutely not. You'd call your doctor and say, my gosh, this looks like it's out of date. I missed it. What can we do? Because that can lead to rejection. Hmm. So the best thing is to always anticipate that outdate. Please, I don't want to have anybody call in and say, well, I have some leftover antibiotics, so should I take them? Oh, gosh, you know, that's always something you hear about. You're supposed to take the whole course of antibiotics, make sure you kill all of the infection. But a very interesting question, David. You got to be careful about that.
Yeah. Well, and I was just interested in the disposal thing partly because, as you say, I think for a long time the advice was you should take it and flush it down the toilet.
Yep,
and
exactly.
Now they're saying, well, actually, maybe we think that's not such a good idea, but I don't know if that means you should just toss it in the trash or some. I wonder whether, in fact, we might get more and more opportunities to turn it in to some central place,
sure,
so that then
it will be incinerated.
Yeah, then it would
exactly.
be incinerated. Yeah,
and that's exactly what happens with hospital waste, and then it becomes inactive components. What are those called? Atoms. And so, you know, there it's not going to pose a threat. And obviously, what you would think about is subclinical concentrations of antibiotics, for example, are the harbinger of superbugs. Mm-hmm. It's absolutely remarkable what that does. It gives the bacteria a chance to understand the antibiotic a little bit more and become resistant because it doesn't kill it.
Yeah, I was struck. I came across an article, and it was in a newspaper, and I believe that it was in Nevada. Anyway, the point was that it was about a senior citizens center that had sponsored an event where what they were trying to do was encourage people to come down and turn in their old medicine, and that they ended up with something like 7,000 pills.
Oh, my gosh.
From a people who had, and so that makes me wonder, if we go in your average American house and we start looking around in drawers and in the medicine chest and, you know, what it is we're going to come up with and how old some of that stuff is.
For everyone listening, once a year, if you take more than 5 or 10 medicines, maybe every 6 months, please go take a look around your medicine cabinet, look for outdates, indates, odd-looking solutions, emulsions that have cracked, things that have partially dried up, and do yourself a favor and dispose of them.
Yeah, all right. We have a caller here, someone with a question.
Great.
In the Champagne, line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Recently, I needed a muscle relaxant, and I, years ago, was given one that I thought was the best I had ever had. Its name was Carbritol, and when I asked the doctor for that, the doctor was not sure it was still in use, and I would like to know whether that's true.
Now, are you sure it wasn't Carisprodol?
Yeah.
Interesting, because that does not ring a bell with me at all.
Okay, well, maybe it's just too old. It was a little white pill with a blue band around the center, and it was called Carbritol, and it was the best muscle relaxant I ever got a hold of.
I'll be darned. And did you try some non-pharmacologic measures in the sense of heat and or cold, depending on where the injury was or what you were trying to accomplish with the relaxant?
Yes.
Gosh, yeah, that can be a tough one if you're cramping and it's not due to electrolyte problems and it's not due to a muscle strain, it's not a side effect. For example, some of the statin medications can cause some muscle aches and pains.
Mm-hmm.
And once you've ruled all of that out, if it's still a spasm, then yes, how are you going to treat it?
Well, thank you so much.
Oh, you bet.
Thank you. Other questions? 333-9455. Toll free 800-222-9455. You can also email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. Our guest is Dr. James Rybacki. He's a pharmacist and has authored a series of books on prescription drugs up until 2006, and now he's doing that via the web at his site, essentialguidetoprescriptiondrugs.com. Here, of course, we are ready for your questions. If you have questions about medication that you're taking, you can give us a call. Something that you touched on right at the beginning of the program, and I'm sure that if you ask any doctor about this, you're going to get the same comment. You ask about, do your patients take their medicines the way that they're supposed to?
Oh, my God.
And I'm sure the doctor would say no. Now, you know, there could be a number of reasons. It could be that people really don't understand how they're supposed to take them. It could be that they're just so busy and they got a lot of things on their minds and they're not remembering. They could actually be willfully not following the doctor's advice. Is it all of the above?
You know, when you look at that, that's actually called non-adherence or non-compliance. And while that sounds a little harsh, it's basically not taking your medicines. About half the people who get a prescription over time, especially with asymptomatic, ongoing, or chronic conditions, stop taking them or don't take them correctly. I mean, if we had a car tire like that, that would be remarkable. And, you know, if you look at our healthcare system, and, you know, what I would strongly advise to the Obama administration, you've got $100 to $160 billion problem that leads to hospital admissions, progression of disease. And for people, patients listening, if you're not sure how often to take it, what to do with it, bring someone with you to that doctor's visit. Get yourself a coach. Make sure they write down all of what Dr. Smith may be talking about so that you understand it, and then set some targets to reach in the next 6 months. Mm-hmm. And every time you go back, usually every 3 months, revisit those targets. How are we doing with that target? Come on.
Yeah. And I'm sure that part of the issue is that it can be complicated. To say, for example, if there are some people, you give them a prescription and you say, take 2 pills 4 times a day. Well, some people, that's almost more than they can figure out. And I'm sure for that, that's part of the reason that pharmaceutical companies more and more are going towards formulations where basically all you got to do is take it once a day.
Yep, and that makes sense. There's actually, or once a week, there was actually a newly approved generic medicine for Prozac weekly that Dr. Reddy, I think, was the company. But now that, you know, a once-a-week 90-milligram fluoxetine, the brand is Prozac, so that it makes it even easier to take. Now, the crucial part of that is you got to make sure you take it. Remember that once-a-week issue. But yeah, you're exactly right. One of the things I always advocate is putting together a medication map. On essentialguidetoprescriptiondrugs.com, I'll have a copy of that by this Friday. And it's just a chance to put your pills on one piece of paper and then bring that to each doctor you see and make sure you can fit the pills into your life. And then also add them up. Make sure you can afford them. is that, you know, the pills, if you can't afford it, there's a lot of company programs that can help a ton.
Mm-hmm. And I'm sure that if you have people who are taking multiple medications, that can get to be really expensive. Some people, if they're fortunate, if they have health insurance and they have some prescription drug coverage, that will help. But the prescription medicines are really expensive, and if you're taking a number of them, I'm sure that can add up really fast.
Oh, sure. Well, the other thing that's crucial, there's in Chicago, there's a large organization called the Joint Commission on Accreditation of Healthcare Organizations. And one of the things that they require, if you go into a hospital, you have something called medication reconciliation. Mm-hmm. And what that means is that when you're admitted, somebody, usually a nurse, sometimes a pharmacist, is going to ask you about all the medicines you're taking, prescription, non-prescription, herbal, and we'll figure out what the doses are and what you're doing with them. And when you go home, there's another reconciliation. And a piece of paper will be given to you. This is a requirement for accreditation. And you're supposed to take that to your next healthcare provider. Well, if you see these medicines all on one page and you can't afford them, that's the time to say, this is going to be too expensive to me. Can you page Dr. Rybacki? We've got to find a different way. So that way you're not set up for a readmission to the hospital. You're set up for success. And some social work programs can actually help you get at least a couple weeks supply until you can figure out what to do.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're about midway through this part of Focus, and if you've got questions about prescription medicine, this is the time to call in. Our guest is James Rybacki. He is a pharmacist by his academic training. He taught University of Maryland. He's now president of the Medicine Information Institute. He's the author of The Essential Guide to Prescription Drugs. Now, this was a series of books that appeared for a number of years every year up until 2006, and the 2006 version, I'm sure you can still find it, and the information on that would be still usable. If you're taking medicine that's in there, but what he's done is he's taken this effort to get information out there about prescription drugs to the web and is developing a website, which is kind of a work in progress.
Definitely.
EssentialGuideToPrescriptionDrugs.com. So you can take a look at that, and there will be a variety of information on there. There will be some charge for some kinds of information. Other information will be there, and it will be free to anybody who wants to access it. So that's also another source of information. And here you can call us, 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455, email will-talk@illinois.edu. Here's someone to talk with in Champaign, line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I have a question. At this point, I am taking Actonel 35 mg,
uh-huh.
And it's very pricey. And I had been informed that there is not a generic for it, but a generic for something that's comparable. And the name I was given was Fosamax. Are those two medications actually comparable?
Now, here's the interesting thing about that. The Fosamax was actually one of the first medications. It belongs to a chemical family called bisphosphonates. And we're actually going to put out a newsletter, the Essential Guide to Medical News, and we're going to have a update on osteoporosis in that. And that's one of those key aspects. Actonel and Fosamax are in the same families, if you will, and they work in the same way. They're making your osteoclast and osteoblast have a very good balance, and I know you were concerned about that. But back to your question, yes, when you look at that, Fosamax or alendronate will work in the same way to help you. And the key measurement there is bone mineral density. Did you get a BMD test? Do you remember that?
Yes, I did, and I've had an improvement in density.
Yes, the crowd goes wild. And that's what those medicines really do. There's also another one called teriparatide or Forteo, which is a shot, and that actually works on the osteoblast side, the bone-making cells. So if you weren't at Target, that's a way to do it. And are you taking some calcium and getting some exercise?
Absolutely.
That's the perfect thing to do. Weight-bearing exercise actually impacts some little parts of your body called mechanoreceptors. So you're doing 100% of things right. That is super. Now, what about vitamin D?
That too, and I have a prescription that I take, and I also get 10 minutes of sunlight a day if the sun ever shines.
You know, most people wouldn't realize that. Vitamin D and vitamin D levels and not having enough vitamin D is a rampant problem in the U.S. A lot of times this will happen with patients in nursing homes who are there for extended periods because sunlight helps your body make active vitamin D, and that's what you need to work on these bones. You only have so much in your bone bank, and if you're a thin person to start and your bones are thin to start, you're not too far away from a fracture. So if you're doing all those other things and the density, the bone mineral density is increasing, that's a home run.
Well, I'm very happy with the results. My concern is that the price is just overwhelming for the Actinel. So my concern was if I convinced the physician to switch from that to perhaps Fosamax, would they be comparable because the one is generic, has a generic?
Well, yeah, and that's an interesting question, too. A lot of people are somewhat concerned about generic medications, and some of that concern goes back about 15 years or so. All of these generics are regulated by the FDA. You can go to www.fda.gov, and there's actually a book called the Orange Book, which is a nice, easy way to understand approved drug products with therapeutic equivalence evaluations. What that means is that when they're listed in there, then they're equivalent to the brand, and that's how you make sure this all happened. That's a very, very good question, and what you've got then is a less expensive medicine, and so many states and so many health plans are asking people to switch to a generic if there's one available.
Sure. So you say, yes, it really would be comparable, and one might go discuss with one's doctor then.
I think that's a good idea, a good way to do it. Still, make sure that you revisit the targets for bone mineral density. So if you say, okay, we're gonna make this switch, what's going to happen? And usually every 2 years is when you get that rechecked. That's probably because partially the accuracy of the machines, partially because that's what the payers pay for.
Yeah, it was just checked a month ago.
And it was better. That's fantastic.
Yes, improved.
Absolutely fantastic. What basically happens is you sort of reach peak bone density, and then as time goes on, and certainly as females reach menopause, then you start to draw on that bone bank if you don't have enough calcium, and eventually you thin out your bones enough that they become really susceptible to breaking, and you get fractures.
Yeah, and the reason I'm excited about the improvement is I'm 80 years old.
Oh, my gosh, you don't sound 80. That is fantastic.
People tell me that, but I really am. So
I think you're 80 years young.
Oh, thank you.
And or chronologically gifted. That's fantastic. Wow. Good for you.
Okay.
All right. Well, thank you. Chronologically gifted. I'm going to remember that. Our guest this morning, Dr. James Rabacki, and if we have questions about prescription medicines, give us a call, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455, and you can also email your question to will-talk@illinois.edu. It's interesting you get into these questions about generics and whether or not generics are as good as name brand drugs. And I guess I'm thinking about just recently, not very long ago, there was some concerns about over-the-counter products for children to relieve cold symptoms. And there were problems associated with name brand products. And in fact, the advice to parents was, don't use those. Go ahead and buy generic Tylenol, buy acetaminophen, and you know, buy something. They're generic products. They're good. They'll treat the symptoms. They're probably going to be cheaper. So that was a case where there actually seemed to be a problem with some name brand product.
So the way to look at this, if you go to www.fda.gov, these are called good manufacturing practices or GMPs. And that actually follows for manufacturing itself, but certainly for pharmaceutical manufacturing, and the FDA reviews that. And so the challenge was from one particular plant, from, you're exactly right, a very large, very reputable pharmaceutical manufacturer, Johnson & Johnson, there were some challenges in the way the products were being made. There's some questions about concentration. There's some questions about some of the labeling and how that worked, and some contamination. So the FDA said, well, okay. Johnson & Johnson reported this when they found that, and they closed the plant, which is exactly the right thing to do. My understanding now is that there's actually a broadening of that investigation looking at Johnson & Johnson just to make sure that all of the other plants, for example, they have a manufacturing plant in Puerto Rico, that those are okay. And they're doing the right thing, which, of course, there's an interview of the president of Johnson & Johnson on CNBC, and it's very, very, he apologized very, very clearly.
So, though, is there any reason ever to question generics? And I'm not so much thinking about whether they're necessarily going to be a problem, but whether the generics really are the equivalent, and whether when you talk about something like bioequivalency, you know, whether the active ingredient there is really there and it works, and when you take it, it does what it's supposed to. Are there questions like that sometimes?
Now, bioequivalence describes pharmaceutical equivalents that have comparable activity in the body, studied under similar circumstances, and that's actually part of I have the Orange Book on my desk. The preface of the Orange Book, the 30th edition, actually has that in there, and it talks about it. So historically, there have been some isolated cases where there was some question about one particular manufacturer's bioequivalence. But that, and that goes back again at least 15 years, that, given the AB rating system and the present vigilance of the FDA, I've not been concerned about that at all.
Okay. Well, let's talk with another listener here. Someone in Des Plaines, that's up in the Chicago area, and it's line 4. Hello.
Oh, yes. Hello, doctor. I have a question concerning the reaction I'm getting from I recently had I take Flomax 0.4 milligram once a day.
Mm-hmm.
And I've recently been told by the doctor, because of some difficulty urinating, that a second tablet was necessary. And so there's one in the morning and one in the evening.
Uh-huh.
When I'm intimate with my wife, I find that at the point of ejaculation that I feel my body tells me that I'm ejaculating, but I'm not getting a release of sperm. And I have reported that to the doctor, which she didn't believe was any particular concern, but it was a concern with me, and I just wonder if you have any thoughts about a situation like that.
Interesting. So Flomax, for our listeners, that's actually an alpha blocker, and that's actually – did you have a prostate problem, an enlarged prostate?
Enlarged prostate is what I've had for a number of years, yeah.
Uh-huh. And so when you look at that, that's a challenge then in actually being able to urinate effectively. And looking at that, it becomes, what's the benefit to risk? And so looking at side effects and challenges with that, that's something that the risk of some problems with it, you know, certainly outweighs the benefit. And the question that you're having there, when you talk to your doctor, tell me what she said about that.
Well, as I described it to him, he said that the sperm itself would be produced but not released, and instead apparently some sort of a flow back into the bladder that it won't. I was so taken aback by that, I didn't ask the question, well, what happens when it gets to the bladder? But I nonetheless have been alarmed about it, and yet I'm not sure whether I'm worrying about something that I should be worrying about.
Well, in that sense, then, are you also seeing a urologist?
The gentleman who authorized this is a urologist.
Okay. And so that sensitivity then, and when you think about kind of Flomax in general, Flomax can, the drug itself, can actually decrease semen.
Yes.
That's a relatively common side effect.
I see.
And so one of the other things, which is completely on the other side of the sort of Flomax equation, what you're talking about with ejaculation, it can actually cause a priapism, a sustained erection and painful one that doesn't go away.
So I have never experienced that.
Okay, and those are two things that you certainly need to look for. But in the sense of I know it definitely can decrease semen, and so I'm wondering if you're seeing a side effect of the medicine itself in that it can decrease semen, and so that sense of ejaculation, there would be less there, less of a general amount of ejaculate, and so you would have the feeling that all of it isn't coming out when the medicine itself may have actually decreased the amount that's available to come out. Mm-hmm. So there's a somewhat complicated answer, but it may be the medicine itself.
And are there alternatives? And if I can trouble you with that second question, are there alternatives, and have you knowledge whether the alternatives would be, if you will, the same six of one, half dozen of another?
Well, now, it's interesting. Yes, there are a couple different alternatives in the same family of medicines, and that's something you should ask your doctor about.
Yeah.
The other thing that's interesting, and if you were listening earlier, someone asked about a St. John's wort versus a prescription antidepressant. There's actually something called saw palmetto, which is an herbal product, and in the sense of shrinkage of the prostate itself, and back to a reputable database, the Cochrane database, there is some good data for that. Now, once again, you'd have to have it from a standardized amount and work in concert with your doctor for that, but that is something you might ask your doctor about.
So, but this would be for the shrinkage issue as
exactly.
opposed to the one that...
And to my knowledge, I don't know of that particular product having a decrease on total amount of semen at any particular time, but that's something you need to look a little bit closer at and talk to your doctor about definitely.
Yes, okay. Well, I'll do both then when I'm to see him a couple of months from now, is actually. But he's available by phone, too. I can give him a call.
Oh, excellent. I would never hesitate to give a call because, you know, certainly it sounds like there may be a side effect in that what you're expecting has been decreased by the medicine itself. It certainly is possible. It's a relatively common possible side effect there.
Side effect.
And a very interesting question.
Yes, well, I'm sorry I have it.
Well, so am I. But, you know, if you look at that again, and if you're in concert with your doctor switching over to either a different medicine in the same family by prescription or potentially giving a trial of saw palmetto, and then that relative amount of ejaculate returns to what you know was available before, then you have the answer itself.
Yes, and I assume part of this situation, how big I don't know, also has something to do with aging, that the amount of sperm somehow decreases with age or something.
Now, looking at that as well, and looking at relative amounts of testosterone, looking at relative amounts of the technical term is spermiogenesis, that clearly could also be happening.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because I do take medication for the, what was it you were just saying?
The spermiogenesis?
No, the other medication that endocrinologist gave me a medication.
Oh, no, wait. Now, if you're taking something from an endocrinologist,
yes,
that says that you have a problem with blood sugar. Is that correct?
No, it's androgel.
Oh, okay. So what you then have is testosterone and a lower amount of testosterone, and so this is a testosterone replacement.
Yes.
I understand completely.
Yeah.
And so that very clearly says if there was a lower level for whatever reason, then, yes, that's something that potentially would help that. How long have you been taking it?
I would say probably the past 10 years of my life.
Oh, gosh. Okay. So, yep, you've been trying to keep that steady state level there. Still, over time, as we get a little bit older, those things may not respond as well, you know, to very adeptly prescribed pharmaceuticals just because we are getting older. And that's actually a very astute question.
Okay. Well, not to take any more time, I do thank you, and it reinforces I need more discussion then. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
All right. Well, thank you. We have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus. Our guest is Dr. James Rabacki. He is a pharmacist by his academic training. He taught at University of Maryland. He's now president of the Medicine Information Institute. He's the author of The Essential Guide to Prescription Drugs that was published as a book for a number of years. The last edition of that was in 2006 and is now doing the same kind of thing, trying to do the same kind of thing, providing that information via a website, which is theessentialguidetoprescriptiondrugs.com. As he explained a little earlier in the program, part of his interest was to have something that would be more up-to-date as possibly can be, than a book. And so it's there, and you can take a look at it. It will be developing over time. Some information there is free. Some information there you have to pay for. You can check it out. But, of course, here on the program, program, the information is free. And if you have questions, you can call us, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455, and email will-talk@illinois.edu. Let me ask you a question that comes to mind after hearing the discussion you had with last caller. We know that there are families of medicines where the individual medicines in the family, they're chemically different enough so the drug companies can patent them and then claim that they are different. Now, if you ask doctors often about these various medicines, they would say, as far as they're concerned, they're all the same. Now, having said that, we also know that we could take a group of people, give them the same medicine, and see that it works differently in different people. So that's the question. In, you know, within a family of medicine, say, you know, like proton pump inhibitors or anything else you could think of, where there's a number of them, they're distinct, they have different names, but the doctor says, it's all the same. Well, is it really all the same?
You're going to force me to say structure-activity relationship. I knew you were going to do this.
I noted that down, that I should do that, yeah.
The point here, though, is that if you look at sometimes there are just slightly different chemical additions, methyl groups for those of you that are loving chemistry, that then make a drug different and then patentable. But if you looked at, in a very serious research lab, small quantitative differences, from one particular member of a family to the other, they often do. Sometimes they don't, but they often do. Part of the other question you brought up, David, that's really interesting, is individualized therapy and pharmacogenomics. This is remarkable. I think there's about a $30 test now that will let you at home take a look at some genes that you might have. It's from a little company called Pathway Genomics. And what that'll tell you is, well, gee, do you have a particular gene that may be associated with an increased risk of Alzheimer's? The more important point for what we're talking about is that liver enzymes metabolize a lot of drugs. So if I give 10 different people a medicine that's metabolized or made active by the liver, they may react differently. And that's a very interesting point. And so the next question becomes, well, how do we test for that? And how do we know if Rybacki is going to react well to this, especially if it's a medicine that's going to protect his heart or make him less likely to have a stroke?
So then it does make sense if we're talking a patient, say, is taking a particular medication and they just don't feel that it's having the effect that they would hope and the doctor would hope, that it is reasonable to go to the doctor and say, well, look, this doesn't seem to be working. Can we try something else? And I guess my question would be, well, if the doctor says, well, yeah, you can try something else, but it shouldn't really make any difference, should the patient say, well, let's see?
Yes. And that's part of being your own best advocate in your healthcare. And that's patient-centered care almost by definition. If you have a question, and if you get a new prescription in the office, again, tackle the doctor in a very benevolent way and make sure that your questions are there. Bring a coach with you. I strongly, strongly advocate that, because if you get a new diagnosis or if someone's relatively in a hurry, and I know we can be, they're going, well, it's an ascending pyelonephritis. We give some step to BID for 14 days. My gosh, what did they just say? Your mind goes into brain freeze. Mm-hmm. And someone, your friend, your brother, your mother, your wife, whoever, can go, excuse me, what did you just say about that? I think we need to talk about this more. When will we start to see the benefits of this drug? That gives you a timeline. You put it on the calendar. Okay, so in general, it's going to take 2 weeks. Well, might take a month. And at a month, if you're not at that target or you're not seeing the benefit, yes. Make an agreement with your doctor. Can I call you if this isn't there? And then can we figure out what we're going to do? Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. And for side effects, here again, you know, you could be taking some kind of medicine and then something could happen. You know, you could be taking medicine and you could get a headache. You could be taking a medicine, you could get diarrhea. Well, there's all kinds of reasons for having diarrhea and headaches. It could have nothing to do with that medicine, but I suppose it's possible that it could. I mean, how do you think about something that's going on, if you think that it's out of the ordinary, and at the same time you happen to be taking some kind of medication, whether there's any relationship and whether it's worth your trying to get with your doctor to say, hey, this is going on and I'm kind of concerned about it.
You start with that question right in the doctor's office. Hmm. So with this particular medicine, let's say you have a high cholesterol and you're going to get a statin drug. What should I look for and what things do I need to call you about? Yep, you might get a headache from one of those medicines. Some people do. You might get a little stomach upset. But, you know, if you're not exercising and you start to get what feels like a little bit of a muscle cramp, and if that persists without doing any exercise, there's a rare side effect that the Crestor that I take, the Lipitor that my mother takes, Pravacol that other people are taking, can cause, and it's an inflammation of the muscles. That's something you need to call your doctor about and then figure out what to do, change medicines or lower doses. And, for example, I didn't tolerate one of the medicines in that statin family very well at all, had that huge cramping and bad feeling, and changed to another one and haven't had a problem since.
So it can really, again, that maybe that goes back to the earlier question, that changing to a different medicine could well make a big difference in terms of how well it works, potential side effects, the whole deal.
Absolutely. And if you look at that, in particular, the statin family, there's actually the first video that I've done on EssentialGuideToPrescriptionDrugs.com talking about diabetes relative to those medicines. It appears that there's an association. You can't say it's a cause yet, but based on more than 90,000 patients and 13 well-designed studies, it appears there's an association between these statin-type drugs and risk of diabetes. Now, it doesn't seem to happen in people less than 60, but it looks like there's something there. Does that mean it's a bad drug? No! It means you have to look for it.
We have a couple minutes left. Again, if somebody wants to call real quick, they can get a question in here. And the time remains, 333-9455. That's for Champaign-Urbana, toll-free 800-222-9455. Is there anything else that's really really hot in the news that you just might want to have the chance to mention?
Actually, there's an interesting drug for weight loss. There was the American Society of Hypertension, ASH, had its scientific meeting about May 4th. And there's a new drug that's actually a combination. It's called Qnexa, and it's interesting in that it's a combination of phentermine that we've heard about before and what we would think of as a seizure drug called topiramate. And it looks very, very promising, and it sort of will fill a gap from a Sanofi drug called rimonabant. And it may be an interesting point for weight loss because, you know, we all struggle with weight. And God bless Michelle Obama for becoming the first lady of weight. I think that's fabulous. Talking about obesity in children and trying to get them moving, what an incredible challenge when they're bombarded with Supersize Me.
Yeah. Yeah, we got now a couple of callers here. We'll see if we can accommodate them in the time that remains.
Okay.
So that's the thing. Sometimes it comes down here really close to the end, and then I say call, and suddenly people start to call.
Well, I'll come back.
All right. Well, let's go to line four. Caller here on our toll-free line. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Yes. Wondering if he is familiar with the new medication for MS called Ampira. Used to be called famperidine or 4-aminopyridine is an old drug.
Yeah, that's exactly that. What are you seeing with this?
Well, my husband is on it now.
Okay.
And hasn't noticed too much change in 3 weeks. Just wondering if you're familiar with it and what could be expected.
Don't do a lot with MS. And are you being followed by a neurologist?
Yes.
Okay, good. And so did you set a target for the first month and what you expect to have as a benefit?
No, he didn't do that.
That's something I'd give a call back and say, you know, I'm really kind of concerned about this. You know, what's going to happen and when should we see the benefits from it and what should we look for? And I think that'd be a very, very healthy discussion to have. Is insurance covering it?
Yes, it is.
Oh, that's very good. That's very, very good. That's it's somewhat a little unusual, but a very, very good thing.
It's supposed to help the motor fatigue.
Right.
So you are familiar with it.
Oh, sure, in that sense, yeah.
Uh-huh.
But the question again there, MS is actually sort of a constellation of things. that are neurologically being challenging. And so when you look at that, the response in one person may be somewhat different from the other, but give that neurologist a call and ask about what benefits you should see when, and then ask about dose changes and what you should do if you don't get that benefit. That'll put your mind at rest.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thanks.
You
and we'll try to get one more question here.
Let's
line,
do that.
Line one in Urbana. Hello.
Hi. I was tuned in late, wondered about the bone density. I think you were talking about it when I called.
Yep.
Where could I read up on results for the different kinds of bone density, you know, whether it's good, bad, or poor?
Well, actually,
and the drugs that you might be taking. I do take Fosamax, but...
Okay. Actually, if you go to www.nof, the National Osteoporosis Foundation.org,
N-O-F.
Yep, National, or just Google National Osteoporosis Foundation. They'll talk about the bone mineral density test, and they'll talk about the medicines and treatment. And there's basically two different kind of cells that are fighting or winning in your bones. One are called osteoblasts. The other one are called osteoclasts. One kind of breaks down the bone a little bit. The other one rebuilds it. And the medicine that you're taking actually sort of fights the ones that tend to break the bone down a little bit. And the bone mineral density and that result, did you hear a word from your doctor maybe called osteopenia?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Okay. What that means is lower than normal bone density. So, you've got kind of a poor bone bank is the way to think about it in a way normal people talk sense. And so that's sort of a risk then if you don't start to fix it with some kind of treatment to progress into osteoporosis.
Mm-hmm.
And what you want to make sure is that if you're just osteopenic, which is sort of a thinning of the bone, you want to stop that and have the density go back up. Now, the scores themselves, one of my best friends is at Beth Israel in the biomechanics lab, and we're going to do a newsletter on osteoporosis, but one of the key things is the scores would confuse anybody but a statistician at a major academic center.
And we're, you know, I hate to do this to you, but I got to jump in because we're really at the end and we're going to have to stop.
Okay, I'm sorry.
No, my apologies. Maybe I shouldn't have taken the last call. Why don't we say sometime soon we can do this again and we can talk some more about these sorts of questions and hopefully answer some more questions from listeners.
Absolutely.
Hey, thanks very much. Our guest is Dr. James Rybacki. You can look at his website is the Essential Guide to Prescription Drugs.com.